Well, nice to meet you folks, if only virtually. So today I'm going to tell you about classical and quantum black holes. This is an incredibly exciting subject. So let me get started. So black holes are, of course, one of the most awe-inspiring objects in the universe. They imply the end of space-time as we know it, and also appear to imply deep paradoxes when we try to meld quantum mechanics with gravitation, in particular in this black hole context. And as I said, there's actually, in fact, been significant progress, both observational and theoretical, in black hole physics in the past few years. I want to tell you about these exciting developments. And my message is going to be that the black holes should be thought of as like the hydrogen atom of the 21st century. By studying this particular system, I think we can learn a great deal about what quantum gravity is, and in fact, about other subjects too, for instance, information theory, and how it very surprisingly might connect with gravity. So let me get started. So let me tell you a little bit about classical black holes. So we now know that astrophysical black holes exist and behave, to a very good approximation, the way that Einstein's classical general relativity says they should, and at least the exterior. We should emphasize that we only have information about the exterior of the black hole. So Karl Schwarzschild in 1915 was the first person who wrote down, actually immediately after Einstein's general theory of relativity appeared, he wrote down the first solution. And this solution, in fact, was the black hole solution, sadly, while fighting and dying in World War I. And so his solution has a property that has an event horizon, a black hole event horizon. Not that they realized really this property at the time, but it's there in his solution. And a crucial aspect of what I'm going to tell you about later, and I hope you can see my pointer here, is that the size of the black hole, the Schwarzschild radius, the radius of the event horizon, is twice Newton's constant times the black hole mass over c squared. Okay, so this property. So I want you to remember that the Schwarzschild radius, the size of the event horizon, goes linearly with a black hole mass. Mm-hmm. And so to give you an idea about what this Schwarzschild radius is for various objects, for a solar mass black hole, the Schwarzschild radius is just under 3 kilometers. Okay, so if we crushed adiabatically the sun down to 2.92 kilometers, it would go inside its event horizon and form a black hole. Incidentally, if we maintained a constant distance from the sun, so we stay here on the Earth, our current distance away from the sun, and we did this adiabatic crushing, the force of gravity here on Earth that we feel from the sun wouldn't change. It's not like suddenly the black hole strength causes gravity to become much stronger. The reason why the strength of gravity is so much stronger at the black hole event horizon is just because we concentrate a tremendous amount of mass and energy in a very tiny volume indeed. And it's because we can approach much more closely. So of course, usually when we go to the sun, you can only get as close to the sun as the surface of the sun. But here we crush it down to 3 kilometers. And that's the reason why the gravitational effect of a black hole is much larger. It's because we are concentrating it so much. So anyway, that was a solar mass black hole. We also know there exist supermassive black holes in the center of almost all galaxies. And these have masses somewhere between the range of 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 solar masses. And therefore, correspondingly, they have a size which is quite large. They have sizes which are of order 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 9 kilometers. And so, for instance, if you fell into a galactic center, supermassive black hole, you don't immediately die as you cross the event horizon. Actually, you don't notice anything particular happening to you. In fact, it takes you quite a few minutes until you reach the singularity and finally die. So you can live, so an observer, according to our current theories, our understanding of black holes, can live for quite a long time inside a black hole and could make measurements. So it's an interesting question to ask, what would such an observer see? And maybe we can discuss that later on in the question and answer sessions. We could also consider a hypothetical black hole of Earth mass. And if you crush the Earth down to a black hole, it would have size just under 1 centimeter. So this gives you an idea of the sizes of some possible black holes, actually physically realized and possible hypothetical ones. So what does the solution look like in equations? Well, when you're talking about general relativity, you have to talk about the space-time distances, the nature of geometry. So here we have ds squared is a space-time distance between events. And this is given by this expression, involves on four coordinates. Two of them are just the normal angular coordinates, d theta, theta and phi. And that this is just saying that everywhere there's a normal spherical behavior, spherical symmetry behavior of the system, where the area of a given sphere is 4 pi r squared. So this is this here. But now we have this issue here where we have this second term here gives you the fact that as you approach the horizon, this denominator here is going to zero. So this factor here, there's an infinity that's appearing here times dr squared. And this is telling you you get radial length contraction as the horizon is approached. On the other hand, this first term here, this factor, this is also going to zero as you approach r to rs, as r gets to r, you go towards the horizon. And this is saying that according to a static external observer, right, far away from the black hole, there's time dilation as the horizon at shorter radiuses approached, right? So there's both time dilation and radial length contraction in this geometry. Well, that's in equations. And of course, you can study this greatly. And I want to emphasize that the modern understanding of classical black holes is due to, of course, a number of people, Wheeler, who coined the name black holes, which we'll see later is a somewhat inappropriate name, in fact. Kruskal, Kerr, Thorne, Hawking, and especially our own Roger Penrose. I think Roger made the greatest contributions to our modern understanding of classical black holes. So what do these awe-inspiring objects look like? Well, here they are. Here's a lovely little Etsy baby black hole you can purchase for the low, low price of just £10. Here's a baby black hole with an accretion disk. In fact, astrophysical black holes have accretion disks. You can get these things with adoption certificates. That's lovely. Here is a different picture of what a black hole looks like. We can take this geometry, and of course, it's very hard for me to represent the geometry of this situation in two dimensions, but let me try. So this is a picture of radius and time here. So each of these points you should think of as a particular four-dimensional thing. There's as a two-sphere sort of living above every one of these things. And what I want to emphasize is this is the exterior, this white region is the exterior geometry of the black hole. And then we have this horizon. And the crucial thing is, as you go inside the horizon, in fact, space-time itself is not really static inside the horizon. The reason is because, and you sort of get a hint of this from this thing, as you go, R is less than RS, notice that this term here changes sign, and this thing here changes sign. So that means now there's an overall negative sign in front of the dr squared, and there's an overall positive sign in front of the dt squared. And that means this now becomes a spatial-like coordinate, and this is the temporal coordinate here. So in fact, there's a definite coordinate system where you see this even better, but you get the hint about what's going on here. And the idea is that, in fact, the radial coordinate becomes a temporal coordinate. So in fact, as you're going on with this thing, in fact, space-time itself is dynamical here and is dragging you towards the singularity as you go down. So this, I hope you see this picture being animated here. Okay. As I emphasized before, passing the horizon, nothing special happens to you. There's no infinite forces. You don't necessarily get ripped apart at the horizon. A freely falling observer just thinks the horizon is very much like empty Minkowski space. In fact, the only place where something truly singular and terrible happens to you is here, right at the singularity, r equals zero in these coordinates. But we should be wary about this because, in fact, the classical solution, and in fact, Einstein's classical general relativity itself is not reliable here. So I want to emphasize to you that even though this singularity is predicted by classical general relativity, we know the theory is not really self-consistent here. So we believe that it self-consistently describes the exterior geometry and near the horizon, but once we start approaching the singularity, we don't know what the physics is. And that's, of course, the subject of active research. I'm trying to understand that. So here's another picture of what a black hole looks like. And so here we have radius again. So here is a star collapsing to form a black hole. And here we have an event horizon forming. And so the crucial thing about the event horizon is here's drawn our light cones. So this, so what happens is light rays, quote unquote, ingoing or outgoing light rays have to be, they're on the edge of this light cone here. And material objects, massive objects, always have to travel less than the speed of light. So they always have to travel with inside the light cone. So signals can only be sent in these angles here. So this one here is ingoing light ray and would go into the, let me go back, into the black hole. But this one here would escape to infinity. But there's this distortion of space-time in the black hole background, and what happens is the light cones tip over. So once you go to the event horizon, now you see right at the event horizon, the outgoing light rays actually go right along the horizon. All material objects inevitably get dragged into the singularity. That's the only possibility. And ingoing light rays, of course, go very quickly. So it's this tipping over the light cones forcing you to go to the singularity. This is another way of saying that inside the event horizon, forward in time becomes radially inward. All right, so that's the thing. But there's another thing here, which is again, a freely falling observer. A freely falling observer going through this system, I mean, we'll go through the event horizon, hit the singularity, but nothing special happens to this freely falling observer as she falls through the horizon. It's just the usual finite tidal forces you always get when you're in external gravitational fields, all right? So there will be tidal forces on this person. So it's a tiny black hole. These tidal forces might be strong enough to rip the person apart, spaghettify her. But otherwise, if it's a large black hole, like a galactic center black hole, falling through the horizon of such an object, again, nothing special happens. The observer will survive, a human would survive, and only when you finally get to the singularity would she be destroyed, okay? So I want to emphasize, if we go back to the metric, it looked like there was apparently singular behavior in this metric near R equals RS. And that's why it in fact took roughly 45 years or so before people took black hole solutions seriously. They thought, in fact, this wasn't sensible. This only could be used as a sort of, it was a mathematical artifact. But later on, it was realized, in fact, there's nothing singular about this solution, apart from right at the singularity at R equals zero. In fact, this apparent singular behavior, the Schwarzschild metric, is just a bad choice of coordinates. It's like longitude if you're at the north and south poles. It's a coordinate that breaks down. It's not truly the physics that breaks down at the event horizon. So that is that. Now, we now know with a very high degree of confidence that supermassive astrophysical black holes exist in galactic centers of most galaxies. And so here is a little movie, which I hope now plays. So this is pointing towards our galactic center, and it's studying over a whole bunch of years the motion of stars. And what you see here is right at the galactic center, and this is a tiny distance, 10 light days, that the stars are orbiting around a very massive, very centrally concentrated object. And in fact, there was a Nobel Prize shared with Roger Penrose this year in 2020, where these two teams, led by these two investigators, independently showed by measuring the trajectories of these stars very close to the galactic center, they're not perfectly on ellipses. In fact, there are general relativistic effects, exactly of the kind predicted by general relativity in the background of a black hole. They're slightly distorting these ellipses. So this is a confirmation you have a supermassive black hole with a very high degree of confidence at our galactic center. So recently we have a direct image of a supermassive black hole, not in our galaxy, but in M87. So this is from the Event Horizon Telescope in 2019. And here is the shadow of the event horizon, and here is the accretion disk. So just like that little Etsy toy you can buy, here, what the light is coming from the accretion disk of the black hole, and here is the shadow of the event horizon. Being shown. So we now know there's a whole range of black holes. And in fact, we have another way of looking at black holes, not just visibly, but we also now hear, in a sense, the sound of black holes merging through gravitational waves. So again, I hope you can, let me just click on this thing. Sometimes this works. Do you hear that sound? Does anybody hear the sound? I hope so. So that is the sound that was picked up in the gravitational wave detectors, the Advanced LIGO collaboration. They have two facilities at Hanford and Livingston in the United States. And this is the sound, the final chirp, as the two black holes, two very supermassive black holes, actually not supermassive, very massive, multiple solar masses, are rotating together and finally colliding. And they merge. And during that final second, the energy released in gravitational waves far exceeds the energy produced by all the suns in all the galaxies in the universe. It's an extraordinary three or four solar masses worth of mass are being converted to energy, almost all in gravitational waves. And so now we've seen dozens, actually hundreds, of black hole mergers. And so there's this merger tree of how black holes are merging and evolving. And of course, there's a nice Letsy thing. And the nice thing about this is the Letsy cartoon you see here is, in fact, it shows these two black holes will be rotating around to each other. The final black hole that's produced is a highly spinning black hole. So it's not a Schwarzschild black hole, but the astrophysical black holes we have are highly rotating. Just for simplicity in this talk, I'm going to focus just on Schwarzschild black holes, non-rotating black holes. Okay. So the summary is we know there's a wide variety of black holes that exist in our universe, and they're very well described by Einstein's by the Schwarzschild solution, or the Kerr solution, it's generalized, the rotating generalization in the external region. So my interest, though, is quantum black holes. That's what I want to tell you about. So the classical theory of black holes is extraordinarily rich, but the world is really quantum mechanical. And so we need to study what the behavior of quantum mechanics, what the quantum behavior of black holes is. And what we're going to find is even more remarkable than the classical case. And it apparently leads to deep paradoxes. And these deep paradoxes, rather like the birth of the early history of quantum mechanics itself, thinking about these paradoxes and understanding how they're resolved is guiding us towards a much better understanding of aspects of quantum gravity. So I want to emphasize there's been significant progress in the last years. Now I'm going to tell you a little bit about what this significant progress is, right, in the next few slides. So the first thing to realize is the most basic quantum fact about a black hole is Hawking radiation. So let me tell you about what Hawking radiation is and why it exists. So in relativistic quantum mechanics, what sometimes we call quantum field theory, empty space, quote unquote, the vacuum, is full of quantum fluctuations of all fields and particles. So it's not a static, you shouldn't really think of it as an empty thing. So here is actually a precision numerical evaluation of the vacuum of QCD. This is on a five Fermi cubed lattice, and this is a time loop of it. And here we just have one realization shown. We're supposed to superpose different quantum superpositions. So we have different quantum superpositions of what the vacuum is doing, but this is one realization. And you see this thing is fluctuating like crazy. We're getting fluctuations on scales. In fact, you see there's a typical sort of scale here, and that's set by the scale of QCD itself, which is Vorder itself, about one Fermi, right? Or 200 MeV, lambda QCD. So, And incidentally, this is verified. These QCD precision calculations now give you quite accurate description of the low-lying mesons and baryons and various other states, other properties. We know this is true. We know quantum fluctuations are there for many reasons. This is one demonstration. So what about Hawking radiation? Well, so here we have space-time, and here's the black hole. And as I emphasized, at least near the horizon, it's just like empty Minkowski space. So we have these positive and negative energy virtual particle fluctuations happening everywhere. We have them happening outside the black hole. We have them happening certainly in the region interior to the black hole, as long as we're not very close to the singularity. We don't know what's going on in the singularity, but certainly in the region around the horizon, we have these virtual particle fluctuations. I want to emphasize there's particles and antiparticles here, but there's the crucial thing is whether they're positive or negative energy. Overall, these things have zero energy. All right, and there is a correlation between their energies, such that they start off in the vacuum, go back to the vacuum, constantly doing this. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have one of these fluctuations in the vicinity of the horizon of the black hole, there's a quantum mechanical tunneling process that allows the positive energy guy here in red, which could be a particle or an antiparticle. So I don't want you to get confused. It's not always that particles come out of the black hole and antiparticles go in. It can be either particles or antiparticles that can escape. The crucial thing is about whether they're positive energy or not. So rarely this tunneling process allows a positive energy particle or antiparticle to escape to infinity, while its negative energy sibling, and this is negative energy from the perspective of some distant observer, particle or antiparticle, is captured by the black hole. And therefore, because it's negative energy, it reduces the black hole mass. So the end effect of this is the black hole mass has gone down slightly and its energy has been radiated away to infinity a little bit. And a little note to experts here, this is a sort of sometimes given as an intuitive picture of Hawking radiation. In fact, this tunneling picture of Hawking radiation can be made precise, and it has an interesting advantage over Hawking's original calculation that it actually explicitly shows that the black hole mass is reducing. In fact, in Hawking's calculation, one deficit of it maybe is that it's on a static background where the black hole mass is not reducing. This tunneling way of thinking about Hawking radiation, in fact, shows that the black hole mass is being reduced. And it's being reduced by this sort of inflow of negative energy from the distant observer's perspective. So the end result of this is physical black holes are never truly black. In fact, they produce thermal radiation in all kinematically allowed modes. And here is a little cartoon. So I want to emphasize dominantly for black holes, it will be gravitons and photons and maybe neutrinos. But in fact, all kinematically available modes are allowed. So the amazing end result is black hole is a thermal system with a temperature, again, as seen by a faraway static observer, T Hawking. And the Hawking temperature, here it is, goes like H bar, it's a quantum effect, C cubed over 8 pi, Newton's constant, K Boltzmann, if we want normal temperature and normal Kelvin units, and then 1 over the mass of a black hole. And if you put in, for instance, a mass of a black hole in kilogram, imagine we had a kilogram-sized black hole, that's a logically consistent thing to consider, though hypothetical in the sense we've never observed such a thing. It would actually have a very high temperature, 10 to the 23 Kelvin. So it's not like this is a small temperature, at least if we have a small black hole. This is a very large temperature for a small black hole. On the other hand, because astrophysical black holes are so massive, solar mass, for a solar mass black hole, it's 10 to the minus 7 Kelvin. So that means that we're never going to observe, at least for astrophysical black holes, the Hawking temperature, sadly. But if you start off with a black hole, let's say you start off with a black hole which is in between a kilogram and a solar mass, well, it would start radiating energy. Its mass will reduce, and therefore its temperature will rise. And there's a runaway process here. That's important to bear in mind. I want you to remember that for later on. So black hole Hawking radiation has never been observed, but we have a high degree of confidence that it's true because we now know many ways it could be theoretically derived, and it solves some otherwise troubling aspects of classical black hole physics. So let me tell you a little bit about one of these troubling aspects. So one of these is associated with the second law of thermodynamics, which of course is that the change in entropy in a physical process should be greater than zero or equal to zero if it's reversible. So Bekenstein argued that to save the second law, one must assign, and I want to emphasize this, a finite entropy to black holes. Otherwise, one could systematically reduce the entropy of the universe by throwing in matter with entropy greater than zero, which then disappears, right? And if you don't assign any entropy to the black hole, then you've reduced systematically the entropy of the universe by doing this process. By just constantly recycling this process, you could reduce the entropy of the universe. This is a pretty bad thing. Bekenstein suggested that in fact that the entropy of a black hole, this finite entropy, should be proportional to the area of the black hole. And Hawking's calculation of the temperature confirmed this, because the first law of thermodynamics says dE equals temperature times dS, where dE is the change in the energy, dS is the change in the entropy. And we now have a formula for the temperature due to Hawking. And we know the energy here is the mass of the black hole times C squared. And if you put this in, so you put the formula in for T Hawking derived earlier, and you put in what this, you just take the derivative of this thing, dE, so it's just dm c squared, you can then find what the change of dS is, dS, and integrate that up. And what you find is you find this expression for the entropy of a black hole. it goes, this is called the either the black hole entropy or the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. It goes like C cubed on G Newton, 1 over H bar, and then the area of the black hole on 4. And in fact, this combination of units here, this defines the Planck length squared, or the 1 over the Planck length squared. So another better way of writing this is 1 quarter of A, the area of the black hole event horizon, over the Planck length squared. Now, I want you to notice, and this Planck length squared, this Planck length is incredibly tiny. It's approximately 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And black hole, of course, black hole event horizons, well, they're macroscopic things. They're, you know, kilometers squared or much bigger. You go back, sorry. Or much bigger for supermassive black holes. Now, what do I emphasize to you here? Notice there's a 1 over H bar here. So that means in the classical limit, H bar goes to zero, the entropy of a black hole in the classical limit will be infinite. And this is why you can constantly keep hiding entropy there in this process, why I showed you Homer Simpson falling into a black hole. So this should remind you of the catastrophe of pre-Planck classical black body radiation spectrum. The quantum effects actually make finite and sensible what will be an infinity in the classical theory. That's very interesting. So what's one way of thinking about this? Well, one way of thinking about the meaning of this entropic formula, that the entropy goes like 1 quarter the area over L Planck squared, is there's 1 qubit per 4 Planck areas of the horizon. So here is the event horizon divided up in little things, and there's a qubit, you know, either 0 or 1, basically on average 1 for every little 4 triangles or Planck areas here. So this is a very, very rich and complicated system. It has an enormous number of qubits. Let me tell you about that. Well, the entropy, if you put in this formula for a solar mass black hole, you find the entropy is of order 10 to the 77 times the mass of the black hole over m solar squared. That means the entropy of a single solar mass black hole is roughly equal to that of the entropy of all the stars in the entire universe. In fact, because this goes like mass squared, and we know there exist supermassive black holes, the entropy of a single supermassive black hole exceeds the entropy of everything else in the universe. Right? So that's an extraordinary statement. Another way of thinking about this very large entropy is quantum black holes are thermal systems with a huge number of microstates. Remember, if we take, Boltzmann's famous formula, S is, let's forget Boltzmann's constant, S equals log W, where W is number of microstates of the system. Well, this says, so I then exponentiate that form, it says the number of states is approximately exponential of this entropy. And this entropy is already huge. So the number of states of a black hole, low-lying states of a black hole, is incredibly large, right? Bigger than a Google, vastly bigger than a Google, okay? So some comments. Well, the information content of the universe appears to be hugely dominated by black holes. That's a remarkable statement. We don't understand well these microstates of black holes, exactly what these microstates are. There's some progress in string theory, but our understanding is certainly not complete. Very interestingly, this entropy, this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, or the black hole entropy, is not extensive. It goes with area, not volume. It doesn't go with mass either. It goes like mass squared. It goes with area. This leads to the idea of the holographic principle, which motivates Maldacena's actually very specific and concrete thing called ADS-CFT duality for certain spacetimes. So this holographic principle says basically that the information content of a region goes like the area that bounds the region rather than the region itself. So there's far less degrees of freedom than you might think in a theory. This is an incredibly rich area that deserves an entire morning in itself. I want to emphasize that we understand holography reasonably well in negatively curved space-times. We don't understand flat space holography currently. Okay. So that's already something remarkable we got out of black holes. But let me turn to some other implications of Hawking radiation. Well, since the Hawking temperature increases as M decreases, black holes can explosively evaporate by a runaway Hawking radiation. And the end temperature of Hawking evaporation of a black hole is almost Planckian. It's incredibly high temperature. So This means that Hawking evaporation is quite extraordinary. Every particle in nature with mass less than m Planck over 8 pi, so that's about 10 to the 18 GeV, can be produced, even if it's completely decoupled from the standard model. And the reason is nothing hides from gravity. This is not using Hawking evaporation. Hawking radiation doesn't depend upon a particle being charged or color charged or anything like that, or having coupling standard model. Nothing hides from gravity. Therefore, Hawking evaporation is a scan over all of creation, even things that are hidden from the standard model. So this way, you can produce, for instance, dark matter, or even start the hot phase of the Big Bang. And so I've been investigating these issues with my students. So these are three of my very good graduate students here at Oxford, Olivier, Rudin, and Hannah. Two of them, I think, are in some of the breakout sessions you'll be able to talk to. So this leads to what could be observable signatures of Hawking radiation hiding in dark matter and in gravitational waves. Very sadly, of course, Stephen himself wouldn't have got to see this, but if we'd seen Hawking radiation, he would have been able to win his very well-deserved Nobel Prize from this. So this is quite incredible. So I'm going to emphasize to you, there's possible observable signatures of Hawking radiation. But there's more, all right? Hawking evaporation implies a remarkable consequence that in any 4D theory, including gravity, there are non-space-time global symmetries are always violated, and they're approximate at best. So let me just quickly describe what this means. This means you can't have exactly degenerate, physically distinct states resulting from such internal symmetries. You can't have an exactly equipotential surface. And let me just explain why this is true. Well, we know Emmy Noether taught us that if you have a symmetry, you have global charges. So if you slightly violate this symmetry, that means the global charges are not conserved. So one example of this would be the non-conservation of barrier number, for instance. Now, normally you say barrier number with some U1 global symmetry, but this must be violated. So here's the argument about why it's true. This goes back to Zeldovich. So imagine you start forming a black hole out of a large initial number N of neutrons. So you crush these neutrons to form a black hole, but then it Hawking evaporates. And this Hawking radiation is independent of whether your initial state is a baryon made of baryons or antibaryons. It only cares about the mass, spin, and charge of these states, not whether they're a baryon or antibaryon. So at most, the final state has plus or minus root N of baryon charge. Here, the blue, there's three blue and one red, so there's one net state. Here we started out with a lot. So you lose baryon number in this process, okay? So global symmetries are violated by Hawking evaporation. Now, we don't understand exactly how this works in full generality, and particularly we don't understand the form and size of the global symmetry violating interactions, but there's progress, again, by groups involving me, but other people as well around the world, and recent progress being made on this issue. That's very interesting. So I'm almost done, so let me make a few final words. So one issue I haven't spoken about is if quantum mechanics and black holes are in fact inconsistent with each other. And this was the view of Stephen Hawking himself for many years, though I would say not for the last 5 years of his life, and might still be Roger Penrose's view. So why is the reason for this? Well, Hawking evaporation of black holes appears to allow for quantum mechanical pure states to evolve to mixed states. If so, this would would violate a fundamental axiom of quantum mechanics and imply information loss. But in the last 2 years, there's been major progress on this issue, and a consistent calculational framework is now emerging. So there's a whole bunch of papers from people from the Institute of Advanced Study, from Stanford, from MIT, from other places as well. And what is their basic idea? Notice there's some very interesting things here, replica wormholes in the black hole interior. This is trying to understand in a real way what is the physics of the interior, what observers who fall through the horizon would see. This is crucial in understanding these issues. And you're having some very interesting things like wormholes appear, other kinds of solutions possibly to Einstein's equations. So the basic idea, and this is sort of for experts, is that Hawking's calculation of this thermal effect, this thermal density matrix, was never exact. In fact, we always knew that his calculation had loop effects there. But in fact, the paradox is all these local quantum field theory loop corrections don't help solve the paradox, it turns out, you can show. But now it's been realized there are new, tiny, non-perturbative effects which are subtly non-local. All right, and that's the crucial thing. They're very tiny. They go like e to the minus area of the black hole over L Planck squared. So they're incredibly tiny. So you may say, how can these incredibly tiny effects make a difference and somehow change mixed states, what looks like a mixed state to a pure state? And the answer is, if you compute the radiation, the entropy of the radiation that's coming out, it's the sum over states of the eigenvalues of this density matrix. And these eigenvalues are now shifted by exponentially small amounts because of these tiny corrections. But there's an exponentially large number of states here. Remember, I emphasized before that the black hole is an exponentially large number of states. So there's an exponentially large number of terms times exponentially small corrections to each one of these terms. And this can lead to an order one modification. And in fact, there are demonstrations in simple cases that this purifies the final radiation. So it leads to pure state evolution, meaning that quantum mechanics is consistent with black holes. So I want to finish there with a statement that quantum mechanics of black holes is even more remarkable than you might have thought, and is guiding us towards a better understanding of quantum gravity, and I emphasize information as well. And so I think there's very good reason to believe that black holes are, quantum black holes in particular, the hydrogen atom of the 21st century. So I'll stop there. Thank you.